Okay, so my talk will continue on the topic of thermalization in closed many-body quantum systems, and the approach that I'm taking is somehow, I'd say, complementary to what Markus was showing us before, namely I will be mainly doing analytical results. And this has the usual pros and cons. The advantage is that one can work in the thermodynamic limit. The disadvantage is one can only look at systems where one can do something analytically. And there's basically two possibilities. Either it's exactly solvable, integrable, well, then one has these whole questions of how generic integrable systems are regarding this thermalization questions. Let's say we add a small non-integrable term and then ask what really happens in the long time limit. And this is an interesting problem, but so far not really solved. And so what I want to look at is therefore the other case of models where one can do something analytically, namely where one can do some suitable kind of perturbation theory. So what I'll be looking at will be weak quenches, and that will turn out to be quench experiments that can be dealt with some suitable perturbation theory. Now, before I get started, I want to give just a very brief reminder that actually these kind of quench experiments that led to this whole thermalization revival is a well-known topic in condensed matter physics well before this collapse and revival paper. And just as a reminder, if we look at the famous X-ray edge problem, so what we are doing here is that a metal absorbs a photon, which promotes an electron out of a deep core-bound state. And so what one would naively expect that then, you know, once we have enough energy to move the electron in the conduction band above the Fermi energy, we will see an onset of the absorption. However, one of the additional effects that is important to take into account here is that when I remove this electron from the deep core state, essentially I'm creating a potential for the remaining conduction band electrons, and thereby I suddenly switch on a one-body potential. And my Fermi gas, which was before perfectly in equilibrium, now sees this potential and is no longer an eigenstate of the final Hamiltonian. So from this point of view, the X-ray edge problem is a quench experiment. So I have an initial Hamiltonian that defines my initial state, and then I have another Hamiltonian that defines the time evolution of this initial state. Actually, similar experiments, but with more interesting potentials that one switches on, are currently underway. For example, in the group of Attach Imamoglu at ETH Zurich, what they are doing is a setup where they basically switch on not just a structural as one-body potential, but essentially a quantum mechanical spin 1/2 degree of freedom. So that basically amounts to suddenly switching on a quantum interaction in a system. You know, this, however, the temperatures at which this experiment is currently being run is, to the best of my knowledge, still considerably above the quantum temperature. But one can do these kind of quench experiments also for more interesting interactions. And then last but not least, I want to mention the question of non-equilibrium Cooper pairing. So that's basically the question, what happens when you, in a Fermi gas in a normal state, suddenly switch on the BCS attractive interaction, and given suitable initial conditions, what one can find are very nice coherent oscillations of the order parameter. I'll come back to this works later. So these are some scenarios in which these kind of quenches are of interest. Now, so what we are doing is we start with this initial Hamiltonian, and here a state which for the time being will always be the ground state of the initial Hamiltonian, and then we suddenly change the Hamiltonian. So essentially, we are performing work on the system, and this work that we perform on the system amounts to that we have put some excitation energy into the system. So if we compare the initial state, the expectation value of the energy with respect to the final Hamiltonian, with respect to the ground state energy of that Hamiltonian, so psi f is the ground state of HF, this will generically be larger than zero. And so one can ask all these questions that, you know, Marcos already addressed in the previous talk. I mean, is there in some suitably defined way thermalization? And that must mean that for a certain set of observables, the long time limit looks as if we are in a suitable canonical state. Of course, as mentioned by a few people already, I mean, a pure state always remains a pure state. So this is no contradiction to the observation that for a suitable set of observables, one can see something that looks thermal. OK, so now the models that I want to look at are models that one can treat with some suitable perturbation theory, which will usually be renormalized perturbation theory. And we will look in turn at an impurity model, a thermodynamic condom model. And then the main part of the talk will be about what happens when we, in a Fermi gas, we suddenly switch on the interaction. So we basically go away from this Landau adiabatic switching on of the interaction, but we do it suddenly, and we ask what's going to happen in the system. And then at the end, I want to say a few things how these connect, or in my opinion, could connect to one dimension. Good. Now, one of the key features that will turn out to be relevant in all these models that we will look at is something that one can understand actually very easily in perturbation theory and even in classical mechanics. And so this is a work that I did with a former PhD student of mine, Michael Möckel. And we start with the following setup. We have a Hamiltonian that consists of an H naught, typically a non-interacting part, and then an interaction. And we look at an observable that has the property it annihilates the ground state of H naught, and it commutes with H naught. We will later see a number of examples where this is, where these conditions are fulfilled. Now, the scenario that we picture is that we prepare the system in the ground state of H naught. And then at time t equals 0, we suddenly switch on this interaction. So the omega naught of t is basically the time-evolved initial state, time-evolved with the full Hamiltonian. And now for systems, for a discrete system, where we can rigorously justify perturbation theory, so we have a discrete set of energy levels that get only slightly shifted by the perturbation. This is not the systems that we will usually be interested in, but in this case, one cannot really prove it. You can show the following. If you look at the expectation value of an observable that fulfills these two conditions, in this time-evolved initial state, now this will typically show all kinds of Rabi oscillations. So what we do is we just average over them and take the long time limit. So if you work out this expectation value in second order perturbation theory, you find that this is exactly twice the equilibrium expectation value of this observable in the equilibrium ground state. This is basically something that you can do in, you can give your students in quantum mechanics 101 to prove this in perturbation theory. Now, this small factor of 2 will have quite important consequences later on.
Equilibrium in the initial or the final ground state?
This is equilibrium with respect to the full Hamiltonian H, the equilibrium ground state of H. Yeah? The equilibrium ground state of the full Hamiltonian. You can prove it very easily. You just write down the expansion of in perturbation theory.
You did a quench.
Yeah, it's a sudden quench.
Not in the ground state.
No,
I'm confused why you call that equilibrium.
No, here omega is the equilibrium ground state of H. Yeah? Right. And omega naught.
Does equilibrium add anything to that statement? You could just say the ground state of H.
Sorry, yeah. Okay. The ground state of H. Sorry, yeah. No, absolutely. The ground state of H. Yeah, yeah. I agree. Yeah. It's the ground state of H. Okay. And we are in equilibrium. Okay, yeah.
This is true only in perturbation theory?
This is true only in perturbation theory, second order perturbation theory. And no, it's not true in higher orders. We will see deviations later on.
Uh-huh.
Okay. We will see deviations. And it's also only true for a sudden quench.
All right.
But we will discuss this later on. Okay, since this factor 2 will be really important, I want to explain it in a bit in a bit more detail in a very simple model system that Michael actually came up with. So now we think of an harmonic oscillator and we do the simplest possible quench, namely we just shift the potential. And now we initialize the system. So I know some people won't be able to see that, but I can't really do anything about it. So the ball is initially lying at the bottom of my potential. And the observable O that I want to look at is simply the energy of the original Hamiltonian. So it's H naught itself. So it's the kinetic energy plus the potential energy with respect to the unshifted Hamiltonian. This obviously fulfills all the conditions that I have up there. Now, if I now shift this potential very slowly, I know that starting in the ground state, I will remain in the ground state. So essentially, what I can do now is I can read off this expectation value, the ground state expectation value. Well, there is no kinetic energy; the ball is just lying down here, and the potential energy with respect to the unshifted potential. Well, you can just read it off. You can just read it off here. So this is basically this expectation value over here. And now we do the same experiment, but we shift this potential suddenly. Now we do the quench. So we shift it suddenly over here. Well, the ball is still lying here. Now omega naught of t has time evolution with respect to the new Hamiltonian. So I get kinetic energy. And at the same time, my potential energy with respect to the old potential, well, basically, you know, it runs like this. And now I time average over this, and you can already see that this expectation value is going to be larger than this one, and it's exactly this factor of 2. Another way where you can do it very easily is, for example, if you look at just squeezing of an harmonic oscillator, then you can also just with a Bogoliubov transformation work this out exactly. And for example, for the squeezing of an harmonic oscillator, you can see that you get this factor of 2 exactly for weak squeezing. And it is the strongest deviate from 2. Mm-hmm. So it's really a result in second order perturbation theory. It's not going to, doesn't hold in general. Okay, so now, of course, I'm not really interested, or not so interested in such discrete systems. I'm interested in systems where I have some continuum of energy scales. So now we just playfully apply this to a system where we can't prove it, namely to the ferromagnetic condom model. This is by itself not a particularly exciting model, but it has the advantage that we can do in a controlled way a renormalized perturbation theory, and we can compare with numerics. So now, so the situation is the following. We have a quantum mechanical spin 1/2, which is coupled to a conduction band of electrons with some now ferromagnetic coupling, J smaller than 0, to make it ferromagnetic. My initial Hamiltonian is the conduction band, and then I have an infinitesimal magnetic field so that the initial state is well-defined. It's a product initial state spin up times the Fermi C. Okay, and then what I want to do is that at time t equals 0, I suddenly switch on this ferromagnetic coupling. And I want to ask the question, what's going to happen in this system? So an observable O that fulfills all the conditions of this small theorem that we saw before is just the set component of the spin minus 1/2. It clearly commutes with HI, and if you apply this on the initial state, it gives you 0. So the statement would be that for this observable, we would expect in the long time limit for time t going to infinity that we find this factor of 2 if we compare the non-equilibrium spin expectation value with the equilibrium spin expectation value. Well, you have an impurity coupled to a large bath. So, of course, if you take everything, if the whole thing is a closed system, but for these impurity systems, the question of thermalization is not so relevant, because if you are interested in the impurity, then you have a very large environment which would basically, you know, take care of the energy you put into the system. But it exemplifies something that we will see later in a really translation invariant system. Now, in
I shouldn't be surprised if this system thermalizes, right? Because you have many degrees of freedom it is interacting with.
Yes. Well, okay. Thermalization here is a bit tricky because this system is non-ergodic, because it's ferromagnetic. So the system will always remember the initial state. But let's say if you looked at the anti-ferromagnetic condom model, the usual condom model, then yes, it does. For the impurity degree of freedom, you do find a crossover to the equilibrium behavior.
But the lead is integrable. The lead is integrable.
Yes.
The non-interacting system. So the system, if the lead is out of equilibrium, it'll stay out of equilibrium.
Sure. I mean, if you look at that, then you can always. You can always construct something that will remember what you did initially. But as you pointed out before, what you're going to construct is going to be very artificial. Like here, you would be looking at, you know.
Also for the lead, I guess the quench you're making is really not extensive. So you're not putting in extensive amount of energy.
Yeah.
So it stays at zero temperature.
It stays effectively at
zero. Infinity.
Yeah. I mean, I had a paper on this a few years ago with Dmitry Lobaskin, where we looked at now the anti-ferromagnetic condom model, and we basically studied the spin-spin. Impurity spin correlation function after a quench, and you can see that it really crosses over from an exponential decay when you basically, you know, just measure the spin expectation value to the usual algebraic T minus 2 behavior if you wait long enough with the measurement. So you can actually show this, but you can certainly construct quantities that are sensitive to the lead that would not show this behavior. I agree with that. Okay, so coming back to the ferromagnetic condom model here, now if we work out the equilibrium spin expectation value, this is something that I think Aprikosov did long, long time ago. What you find is basically 1 plus density of states times j divided by 2 plus higher order terms. J is negative, so this is a bit smaller than 1/2. Now, if one works out the time evolution starting from this product initial state, and this is something I did together, especially with Andreas Hackel, then one finds for large times the following behavior. One has a 1 over log t behavior, and then basically 1 plus rho times j. So I'm not going to say anything about the methods with which we did this. This was based on a flow equation calculation. We'll compare it with numerics on the next slide. But if you compare these two results here, you can immediately see that for this observable, we find exactly this factor of 2, also in the system with a continuum of energy scales in the bath. And now here is the comparison with time-dependent NRG, done by, basically that was done by Rosen and Hofstetter. And here are various quenches. Here's the spin expectation value. And the squares are basically our analytical results. And the crosses are the time-dependent NRG results. And one can see that at least for weak enough, for small enough j, these curves agree very well. For larger j, there are deviations. And if one goes beyond second order, one can also understand why the deviations go in this direction, as a matter of fact. So. But one can see that the numerics, confirms definitely very well the analytical result, and therefore in the long-term limit also this factor of 2 observation. Now, one can go away from this instantaneous quenching, from the sudden switching on of the interaction, and one can ask, okay, now we want to study the full crossover from adiabatic to instantaneous. So we want to switch on ferromagnetic coupling slowly and then faster and faster, essentially over time scale tau. And so if we do it very slowly, we would expect that we stay in the ground state. And so then we should find the equilibrium expectation, the ground state expectation value for the impurity spin. And if we do it very quickly, so if tau is very short, then we should find exactly this factor of 2. So we define this measure of non-adiabaticity. So basically, you just take the long-time limit of your expectation value given this initial state. Okay, in general, you subtract the expectation value with respect to the non-interacting system, and you divide it by the equilibrium expectation value. And then for the system, you get a curve that looks like this. So when the quench is fast as compared to the ultraviolet cutoff of your bath, you get a factor of 2, which makes perfect sense, because then you quench so fast that the degrees of freedom can't follow anymore. And if you quench more slowly, then for some modes, the quench will be instantaneous, whereas for other modes, this will start to become adiabatic, so you expect a crossover, and that's exactly what you see. And as a matter of fact, for this problem, the crossover time scale is non-perturbative in the coupling constant because of the RG flow of the system. So there's going to be a preprint about this result next week, this week actually. Okay, now I want to go to the system that I'm really interested in, and this is now the Fermi liquid. So we are starting from a Fermi gas. So this is the momentum distribution function. And we know, Landau has taught us, if we switch on the interaction adiabatically slowly, we have a one-to-one correspondence between the physical electrons and quasi particles. And our momentum distribution function at zero temperature will show this behavior where we have a discontinuity at the Fermi energy with the set factor, which I already called set adiabatic. And the question that we want to ask now is, what is going to happen if we don't do this adiabatic, but if we do it suddenly? So if we switch on the interaction suddenly, what's going to happen in this translation invariant closed system? Again, we use our small theorem from before. Again, we apply it somehow naively to the system. And the observables that the natural observables that one would identify here is just the momentum distribution function. Nk, all the nk certainly commute with the initial Hamiltonian. And nk for k larger than kf annihilates the ground state, and 1 minus nk below annihilates the ground state. So this would be the observables. Then the expectation would be, if we basically do this second order calculation, that's why I'm talking about weak quenches, so my interaction has to be small. Well, what we would expect for a sudden quench is that these observables differ by a factor of 2 from their ground state values. So if this is the momentum distribution function for the physical electrons, then basically I need to multiply this tail by a factor of 2, and I need to multiply the number of holes by a factor of 2. So from this point of view, the sudden switching looks very much like a zero temperature Fermi liquid, except we have the wrong discontinuity at the Fermi energy. And there is exactly, if we look at 1 minus this discontinuity, there must be exactly a factor of 2. This is, of course, the result that we had first, didn't understand, and then made all the way back to the harmonic oscillator, and then we understood where this factor of 2 was coming from.
Well, Stefan, but yeah. There is not really t going to infinity, right? Because
No. Exactly. Exactly. I'm naively applying this, and we will see in a moment that this is now not the steady state of the system. Now something is going to happen. Next slide. It's a quasi-steady regime. It's the pre-thermalized regime, which I'll come to right now. Exactly. So, and here for, let me just show you how this actually looks like. Now, this is for Hubbard model at half filling, where we suddenly switch on the interaction. This is just how the the dynamics of the momentum distribution function would now look like in this second order calculation. And you see this this kind of buildup. And then in this order of the calculation, nothing happens. But of course, we need to address the question that Mark was asked, is this the whole truth? And it is not. Let's, okay, so here we have our momentum distribution functions for the physical electrons in equilibrium, zero temperature, and after our quench. Now, we ask the question, how does the quasi-particle distribution function look like that corresponds to this distribution functions for the physical electrons? Now, of course, we know in at zero temperature, our quasi-particle distribution function is just, you know, Fermi gas at zero temperature. And because now we have additional states here and holes here, if I map this momentum distribution function to a quasi-particle distribution function, I will naturally have something which has excitations above the Fermi energy, holes below the Fermi energy, and it will be non-thermal. Now, such a non-thermal quasi-particle distribution function is, as we all know, unstable under Boltzmann dynamics. And if one inputs this kind of quasi-particle distribution function into a Boltzmann equation and asks what's going to happen for a translation invariant system, the only thing that can happen is that I get a Fermi-Dirac distribution, which will show up on the time scale, which is U minus 4, so the coupling constant to the minus the fourth power, so long time scale, and a temperature which will turn out exactly proportional, which will exactly correspond to the energy that I have put into the system. So in a way, what we are doing here is we are doing a calculation in two steps. We have an initial dynamics that actually forms the quasi-particles on a fairly short time scale. And then once we have well-defined quasi-particles, we trust the usual assumptions under which one derives the Boltzmann equation, and we plug this distribution function into a Boltzmann equation and look at the dynamics. OK, so now the various timescales in this system, we have, again, an initial fast time scale, which is corresponds to the formation of the quasi-particles, so my air electrons before the quench become dressed by particle hole excitations. Then I have a time window where it looks as if I have a zero temperature Fermi liquid, but with the wrong quasi-particle residue. And then in a fairly long time window, nothing much happens with this distribution function. And this is this quasi-steady state. And one observation about this quasi-steady state is the following. If we look at the total interaction energy and the total kinetic energy in the system,
why don't you go up to time g to the minus 4 in this pre-thermalized state?
It really okay. This factor of 2 starts to change as of the time scale g minus 2. Yeah? But you only have a Fermi-Dirac distribution at the time scale g minus 4. The question is, you know, you go basically, in perturbation theory, you have a jump that is 1 minus g, and it goes to a jump that is 0. And that's why you kind of have, you need to ask, you know, do you look at the deviation from 1? Or how you approach the one half in the middle. So I mean that's why I mean maybe not the best way of writing it down here, but this is basically what's happening. Okay, so now if we look at the total kinetic energy in the system and the total interaction energy in the system, that is plotted here. The sum of the two of us has to be 0. Because energy is conserved, and initially, I mean, the way I have defined my Hamiltonian is such that the total energy of the system is 0. So we have this curve here for the expectation value of the kinetic energy, this here for the expectation value of the interaction energy. And these two quantities actually reach their steady state value already in this regime when the quasi-particles are formed. And this is something that, I mean, somewhat different context, people have called pre-thermalization in the physics of the early universe. You make the observation that certain average quantities, or in that case, an equation of state, already holds while the energy is still distributed non-thermally over the modes. So average quantities already look time invariant, whereas if you look more deeply into it in a momentum resolved way, you see that the way the energy is distributed is non-thermal. And that's why another time scale enters where this total kinetic energy is redistributed such that it becomes effectively thermal.
One question?
Yeah, sure.
If you're slightly away from the Fermi surface, then there is a lifetime of quasi-particle also.
Yes.
Lifetime scale, I mean, should enter some crucial way.
It would enter, yes. So, I mean, it's kind of, what I'm saying here is strictly speaking only true, if I remember correctly, in a vicinity of the Fermi surface of order U, if you really work it out. But we will see later that it seems to hold away from it as well. But I mean, it's true, when we have analyzed that, yes. I mean, it's perfectly correct what you say. Okay, and then on a long time scale, so G minus 4, the quasi-particles start seeing that they actually have phase space available, exactly because of this factor of 2, and they start to explore this available phase space, and they thermalize with a Fermi-Dirac distribution, which is effective temperature that is just proportional to the coupling constant. And then we know that the internal energy for a Fermi liquid is proportional to G squared, which is exactly the correlation energy or the energy, the work that I performed in the system right in the beginning. So for a weak quench, basically, the work it gets redistributed into the kinetic energy. Okay, so it's very gratifying for someone who does something analytical to if numerics shows that this scenarios actually hold to maybe larger values of the coupling constant than you would have expected. And so this is work by Eckstein, Koller, and Philipp Werner, who used the dynamical mean field limit of the half-fold Hubbard model, so the large dimension limit, and they did real-time quantum Monte Carlo for an interaction quench, just as I had described before. And so this is all from their papers. What they plot here is now essentially the momentum distribution function as a function of time. You see here we have a jump that is exactly equal to 1, that's the Fermi gas, and then we see how, you know, this discontinuity, I mean, as far as they can see it here, becomes smaller as a function of time. It's actually a fairly large value of U, and for an even larger value of U, one observes this kind of collapse and revival oscillations. But that's beyond certainly the reach of perturbation theory. Now, what they have done here is that they have now, as good as possible, measured this discontinuity, so measured this effective set factor as a function of real time for different quenches, always starting from the Fermi gas with U equals 0. And now what one can see is, okay, we have an initial dynamics that is very fast. That's essentially the formation of the quasi-particles. And then these dashed lines here, that is exactly the set factor that you would expect, including this factor of 2 in non-equilibrium. So basically what they did is at zero temperature, using quantum Monte Carlo, they just measured the set factor, and then 1 minus set multiplied by 2 minus 1 gave these lines. And this actually, you see there is this kind of knee in the curve, which is this kind of, you know, where the system is in this quasi-steady state. And one finds this, I mean, I must say, to surprisingly large values of U, because that you cannot say in perturbation theory. And you can also see that, you know, if you had just looked at small quenches and you wouldn't know analytically that something is going to happen at U equals 0.5, numerically you can't go further. But, I mean, you can see that there is another time scale where something is happening, except that it is a longer time scale.
What's the unit of time?
That's just, yeah, the inverse hopping matrix element multiplied by some factor 2 pi to some power that I don't remember. Also, it's interesting if you look at this curve here. This is now the quench very close to the equilibrium Mott-Hubbard transition. You see that basically then, you know, this the dynamics is very fast, and the discontinuity disappears very quickly. This is this behavior over here. Okay, so yeah.
The last thing is something you wouldn't see if you are off half filling.
No, no. I don't think they have started off half filling, but that would actually be interesting to compare. Yeah. Okay, now I want to look at one of the consequences of these results, and that has to do with this time-dependent BCS physics that I mentioned at the very beginning. So there has been a number of papers by Barankov-Levitov et al., Lutz Bashian and Altschuler et al., who effectively studied this Hamiltonian here. So we suddenly switch on a BCS interaction, and what one finds, suitable initial conditions, is that one has these very nice coherent oscillations of the order parameter. Now, if one does this in a real experiment, what you are switching on is not just the BCS channel, but you switch on interaction which is local in space, which contains many other matrix elements. And effectively, it has exactly this Hubbard, the Hubbard-like term that we looked at before, except with an opposite sign, which doesn't make any difference in second-order perturbation theory. So what we have basically seen now is that if I switch on, so this is absolutely exact, the result here. But if I now modify this model to a model where I switch on an interaction that is local in space, what is going to happen is that on a time scale, which will be much shorter than the BCS time scale that we effectively see here, the system is going to thermalize. And there is, and therefore, the initial condition for this kind of physics would be a system with an effective temperature which is much larger than the BCS temperature. So if one did this experiment with a sudden quench, at least for small g, it would not work because the physical Hamiltonian contains additional matrix elements that heat up the system. This was, as a matter of fact, already noticed by Barankov and Levitov. And they already pointed that out, that a sudden quench would not work. And as they basically they calculated, they gave a condition on what kind of quench one needs to do, and we will arrive at a result now that is, I think, actually even a bit more generous than the result that they came up with. Now, what one wants to do is, well, you don't want to switch on the interaction suddenly, but you want to switch it on more slowly so that you don't excite the system too much. So what we're doing now is that we do linear ramping on the time scale TR, where we switch on the interaction. And we ask the question, OK, what is, first of all, the momentum distribution function in this quasi-steady state that emerges? And then from that on, we can figure out what's going to happen, how the dynamics will look like in long times. What is plotted here is, again, this factor mu in this quasi-steady state that measures the non-adiabaticity. And as a function now of the energy or the wave vector, if I do a very fast quench, so for some reason these are not ordered, so as compared to the bandwidth of the system, effectively I have a factor of 2. That's exactly the factor of 2 for the instantaneous quench that we saw before. If I quench very slowly, here TR equals to 12 units of the hopping matrix element, then I just have this slight enhancement of my momentum distribution function close to the Fermi energy left. Well, somehow this is what we would expect, that modes for which the quench is slow behave adiabatic, and the ones close to the Fermi energy for which a quench, you know, looks more instantaneous, that they retain this enhanced value to larger ramping times. And but it is one also sees that even at the Fermi energy, you do approach equilibrium. So you don't need to wait. There is no window around the Fermi energy where you need to wait for an arbitrarily long time to approach the equilibrium expectation. But you do approach equilibrium uniformly for all wave vectors as a function of the ramping speed. This is not immediately obvious that this happens. Okay, so now if we now ramp, if we do this ramping, such that
the time scale you have to ramp slower than is the BCS?
Yeah, that's what's coming right now. Exactly, yeah. So in the regime that we are interested in, the effective temperature will turn out to be proportional to 1 over the ramping time scale. And well, the quench, if it's instantaneous with respect to the BCS time scale, this needs to be smaller than 1 over delta BCS. This looks bad because both scales are the same. So you might have a window where you see something, but it would be tricky. However, if one analyzes this picture in more detail, what you find is that a lot of the energy that you put into the system with this linear ramp actually sits at the tails, at high energies. So the time scale that you get for the thermalization is actually considerably larger than the BCS time scale. So effectively, what happens is that, yes, at some point the system is going to thermalize and the temperature will be, you know, proportional to delta BCS. But for a long time, in this pre-thermalization time window, most of the energy sits in the tail of the distribution, and it just takes a long time to scatter down to the Fermi energy where it will really affect the BCS physics. So basically, within this pre-thermalization time window, one will be able to see many of these BCS oscillations. Another possible way of doing this is probably by going away from a linear quench, but to quench more smoothly, which puts less energy into the system. I haven't studied this in detail. Okay, so then, okay, good. So then, now I want to jump to one dimension, and the calculation that I've done so far for that we've done so far for the Hubbard model, by the way, is non-applicable in one dimension. It is non-perturbative. And I want to look at a paper by Miguel Cazzalila in the light of the results that I've just showed you. So what he looked at is basically a Fermi gas, where you one-dimensional Fermi gas, where you suddenly switch on forward scattering. And well, this you can solve exactly via a Bogoliubov transformations to free bosons. And now, these free bosons is a quadratic Hamiltonian. The momentum distribution function for these free bosons is completely time invariant. It doesn't do anything. It's just I just calculated this yesterday. This is how it looks like. And then if you look at the physical electrons, basically how does the momentum distribution function actually evolve as a function of time? Well, this is from a paper of Goetz-Uhrig. Basically what you find is you find a behavior like this as time proceeds, and you see how the typical Luttinger kind of behavior starts showing up, the discontinuity vanishing at the Fermi energy. Now, from the point of view of the results that we have seen before, this is what you would call a pre-thermalized regime. You have a quasi-particle distribution function, which does not evolve anymore because there is no quasi-particle interaction if you only have forward scattering. However, even if we had some interaction, quasi-particle interaction, we know that in a generic one-dimensional system, a two quasi-particle interaction doesn't do anything. So basically, from this point of view, this system does not evolve beyond the pre-thermalized regime because there is no further interaction. And also, if there were one, the mechanism that I showed before would not be effective. Well, if you have a general dispersion relation and you want to fulfill momentum and energy, you don't have any matrix elements. You see, you need to fulfill both of them at the same time in the Boltzmann dynamics, and there's just nothing, you know. I emphasize generic, so I need to go away from linear dispersion relations. So, yeah.
Because it's not true of real dynamics of interacting systems. You're saying that's true in Boltzmann.
Exactly, yeah. But what I'm saying is that basically this picture that I showed before is definitely not applicable in 1D. Mm-hmm. And
excuse me.
Yeah.
You can go with three particle collisions.
Very good question. That's something I'm actually planning to do. You know, that would be an interesting thing.
It's known in 1D. For example, if it will take, say, a typical one-dimensional mm-hmm. system like mm-hmm. the vortex line, it would discuss a cascade of Kelvin waves. Mm-hmm. It's just driven by three.
Yeah.
By six wave scattering.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is exactly one possibility in which one could study how breaking of basically a non-integrable term, to what kind of time scales this could lead. You know, and basically tell people who do numerics, this is the time scale where I might expect something, or the momentum distribution function. You know, it should start evolving again on a certain time scale, because as we have seen in the simple, you know, Fermi liquid, this time scale where the momentum distribution function starts to evolve can be much larger than the initial dynamics. So I very much agree with what you said, yeah. It's on my to-do list, actually. Okay, so, and I think, yeah, then this is what I want to wrap up with. So the picture that I wanted to show is that, my picture is that for systems with well-defined quasi particles, if we do a weak quench in more than one dimension, we have this kind of fast pre-thermalization. However, then the distribution of the energy over the modes will still be non-thermal, and in more than one dimension, it will thermalize, but on a longer time scale. In one dimension, this is not clear what's going to happen. And then what I think is particularly interesting would be the situation where I cannot have a quasi-particle. I don't have a quasi-particle description at all. For example, in this this one curve that I showed you before by Eckstein, Koller, and Werner, where you quench close to the Mott-Hubbard transition, or at strong coupling quantum critical points, where everything that I showed you over here will not be applicable. So a completely different class of systems. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the nice talk. We have time for a few questions, but I remind you that at 4 o'clock the physics colloquium starts, so we should wrap up in time. One question over there.
I have a question about this question of pre-thermalization in the Fermi liquid. And on the pre-thermalization, Berger, Tal, and Bakery, what they understood was the fact that you start with different initial conditions, yet after a time, you cannot distinguish between the different initial conditions. And then after some longer time, an order of magnitude longer, then you will reach thermalization.
Yeah.
Now, in this case, you are always starting with a very specific initial state. And one does not see that there is a disindependence of initial states.
Well, I mean, the way they explained pre-thermalization to me is basically the statement that some average quantities become time independent, but the way they are distributed over the modes is not yet thermal. I mean, this is the way in which I use it. And I think this is also a point that they make in their paper, actually. This is how they define pre-thermalization.
Well, they use explicitly two different initial states.
Sure, but I mean, the way they define pre-thermalization is, I mean, what I mentioned right now. They do also look at more initial states, but the definition that they give is the one that I mentioned right now.
Beyond definitions, I mean, for example, the numerical work, wouldn't that show that if you change the initial conditions, because starting with a non-interacting system is a very specific thing, right? I mean, if you change initial conditions, you would essentially reach the same momentum distribution function.
It would, I mean, starting from some other situation, it would depend essentially on the energy that you put into your system.
Oh, the same energy, of course.
The same energy. Well, then it would look very similar, but the quasi-particle distribution would look different. Yeah, so in this sense, it would be very similar again, yes.
No, because in what Marco shown, in the Fermi case, that's what happens. You start with very different a metal and insulator initial state, yet N of K is the same after time, right? That's, I would say, okay, we forget initial conditions, but if here we do not forget initial conditions, I do not understand which sense we speak of about pre-thermalization.
Pre-thermalization means precisely that the momentum distribution function is not yet. Does still remember the initial state. but that the total energy, you know, that the average energies do not remember it anymore. Yeah, that's exactly how this term is used. Yeah.
Perhaps one very quick question, the 1 minute at maximum.
Yeah, I have a quick question on the whole observables. Yeah, so on all observables, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's a very strong requirement. You're asking like the observable annihilates mm-hmm. the first state, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. initial state, and then it commutes with the initial Hamiltonian, right? Mm-hmm. So all observables for this, you know, the same very same system, they may just relax immediately to the thermal distribution, right?
That's very true, because you know the quantities that are, you know, that show this long time, this quasi-steady state, are the ones that, you know, are local in momentum space. So if you have something local, it will probably, you know, show much faster relaxation.
Okay, then let's stop here and thank you.